listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Susie Warren-Smith, and for the next 30 minutes we're going to be talking all things food and drink. As usual, I'm joined by my fellow presenter, AJ Sharp.
Hello.
Who is a taste expert. Judge for the Great Taste Awards, loads of other awards, food writer, MD of Sharp Relations, you know all that stuff. Today we're talking about collaborations. We're doing a bit of a marketing, what would you call it, masterclass, okay. I would say.
Analysis, like it.
Yeah, so should you be doing collaborations with others? Is it a good idea? Is it not? And our expert today on this very subject, who happens also to be the founder of Square Root, is Robin Sims. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
You've brought some lovely drinks with you, which is very decent of you. Before we sort of go on to collaborations or whatever, could you just explain how you started exactly? Because you're actually a scientist, aren't you?
Yeah.
Your brain is a science brain. My brain is an arty brain. It's not a science brain. You met Ed.
Yep.
At university, while you were a scientist studying at University College London. And when you'd graduated, you started experimenting to make my favourite drink of all time, possibly with the exception of wine, of ginger beer. But explain to me exactly how it started and what your sort of vision was, and then we can explain how you've managed to make the company grow.
Of course. So, yeah, I'm a chemist by training and a mathematician, the two most boring things for most people. And my partner, Ed, is a biologist, so we've got most science covered. And yeah, we met at UCL. Ed's a little bit older than me, so he graduated before I did and didn't know what he wanted to do. I graduated a couple of years later and also didn't know what I wanted to do. He went off and started working in brewing. So this is kind of like 2010 to 2012. So
that's quite biologist centric, yeah. Isn't it? Because you've got to understand that. So a lot of microbiology stuff will go into that sort of side of it, won't they?
Yeah, lots of cleaning, lots of like looking after yeast and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So yeah, craft beer was really starting to become a thing in London around that time. I left uni and went to work in the closest pub to my uni, which was very comforting, the Euston Tap. And essentially their whole thing is that they had 100 different beers in the fridge, 20 different beers that you could get on tap. But if somebody walked in and wanted a soft drink, all they could get was Coke or Diet Coke, which I thought was really boring.
Especially now so many people don't drink.
Yeah, it wasn't quite so much of a thing in 2012, but definitely more now, yes. But we had people coming in every single day saying, hey, I've just started a brewery. Here's this beer. It's got this exciting ingredient, this exciting hop. You should sell it. And I just kind of thought that no one was doing the same thing for soft drinks. So I did the completely normal thing of making ginger beer in my kitchen and coming up with a recipe, which was probably heavily influenced by my science background. So lots of trial and error, lots of experimenting. And yeah, cycled it to the nearest farmer's market I could find and started trying to sell it to people.
Awesome.
Excellent. So very community orientated for you. It was about where you were, you know, physically, and then going around, you know, around the local community, trying to sell what you're doing and trying to establish the brand there first, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. It was just what a lot of other people were doing at that time. I think East London was really starting to become the place where food and drink businesses were starting. It's got a great community vibe. Lots of people are very supportive, and there was lots of different opportunities to just try different places to sell it and different things.
And this is in Hackney, in London, yeah. And so surely that is the best thing to do rather than try and go straight into supermarket listing where you've still got so many things to learn. Was if you can do that in this sort of experimental, being a scientist, I'm going to experiment and, you know, do my trials and that sort of thing. But then you can talk to customers, you can refine it, you can get the price just right. Is that what your thinking was, literally as a scientist? Well, I need some controls over here. I need this and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. It's having the controls, but then it's also leaving it completely open to people's experiences and what they think. Because if someone's paid £2.50 for your cup of ginger beer and they don't like it, they are going to tell you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you give somebody something in the UK in particular, I think people are always going to say, oh yeah, it's nice, and you're never going to actually get the feedback that you're looking for. Whereas if you sell it to somebody, they will tell you if they hate it.
Yeah, that's great. So you're beginning to refine your product. How did you then decide on the branding? Did you say, well, this is our target market, and therefore we're going to work backwards from that and reflect who we think our target market is? Or did you say, no, we're going to be really bold and brave because this is us and this is what we're going to look like? Because I think those are your two options, don't you, AJ?
Absolutely.
So this is actually the second iteration of the branding that we're on now. Originally, it was actually completely radical in the soft drink sector to actually be making drinks from fruit and not from fruit concentrate or flavorings or anything like that. So originally we were like, well, we have to find the simplest way to communicate that it's actually made from a real thing. It's assembled somewhere in a factory. So we went for botanical drawings of the fruit that were in them, because nobody else was really displaying that on bottles.
So what you're trying to do is mark out your differentiation.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you've got a mass-produced ginger beer next to this, it becomes very obvious why they're different. That's your thinking,
yeah,
I'm guessing.
Exactly.
Okay, so you get into all these different places, starting to, on your bike, you know, cycling around. How many flavors did you start off with, just with the ginger beer, or do you think it's important to have a range right from the beginning when you go and sell, because that's what a pub or a restaurant's looking for?
So we were just selling literally from a 20 liter keg into cups at events.
All right.
And that's obviously great in June, July, and August, but as soon as the weather starts to turn, no matter how much you try and sell people hot cups of ginger beer, we had to kind of figure out a way to sort of ease out the seasonality of our business. Mm. And that's when we started developing the bottles. And yeah, then it was really important to have a range of drinks, because you would go in somewhere and say, oh, I make a great ginger beer. And really, they're looking for...
They want a range. Yeah,
you know? They want a range. They want one supplier. It was very different to beer, which I think we didn't really know at the time, is maybe a pub or a bar would stock 10, 20 different beer producers, but really they're just looking for one soft drink because it's kind of the unloved part of the bar.
And it shouldn't be.
It really shouldn't be.
And they need the equivalent of a Coke and a lemonade and all the things people are expecting to see in that environment, don't they?
Exactly. So when you go to a pub and you order a drink, you don't say, can I have a square root? You just say, can I have a lemonade?
Yeah.
So it's about you getting into those places is really important. The horrendous J2O, which it's awful. In a way, this is what you're doing. You go, I like an orange, I'd like a lemonade. And it's just like, well, square root do all of those things. Mm-hmm. So if you are building up a drinks brand of some sort, you need that stable, if you like, of different drinks. And probably that's the same with other categories like jams and, you know, all sorts, isn't it? Crisps. You're going to be expected to have not just one product, but a range.
Certainly in retail. I know that often you get two or three SKUs, which means two or three different kind of flavor varieties that they like to have side by side. You might swap in one and out, swap them in and out during different seasons.
Yep. So I'm looking now. So you've very kindly brought along, we've got raspberry lemonade, kind of a pink, beautiful, proper lemonade, I would call it. Then we've got citrus crush, which has got orange and
grapefruit,
ginger beer, rhubarb, which I've just had is lovely, and cola.
Yeah.
So can you talk to me about cola? What is Coca-Cola and what is cola? So Coca-Cola isn't just only Coca-Cola own that. Cola is a drink.
Yeah.
What is it?
Tell us. Oh, it's a really hard one to explain. Originally, it was a drink made up of botanical extracts. It was actually a health drink, so you drank it because it was caffeinated, because it had extracts from plants in it, and it was refreshing. That's how it started. And this, our version, is kind of a bit more of a nod to that, so it's all organic essential oils. We use lemon and lime juice.
Are cola nuts a thing?
Cola nuts are a thing. Yeah. We don't use them because I think they taste horrible.
Really? what are they?
It's a nut, kind of.
No.
I think it's actually a seed, technically. This is the question that you need to ask Ed. Is cola a nut or a seed? But it's something that you chew because it has a stimulating effect. So it, people chew it because it's highly caffeinated, and it also has another compound in it that helps keep caffeine going in your system. But we tried them in the very early days, and it's like chewing on a paracetamol. It's incredibly astringent.
Yeah.
And it's not very nice. So we were kind of like, why bother?
So your cola then is a nod to what people in their mind would think of as Pepsi or Coca-Cola.
No, it doesn't. Okay. It doesn't taste anything like that.
But if somebody orders a cola, they will have that in their head. They will have a reference of what they think it tastes like. So you've got to have some nod towards that, surely.
Yeah, so
it can't taste like lemonade.
It does taste, it tastes more like cola bottle sweets. That's kind of the
yeah, I get that.
The angle that we've gone down. And it is based on the original Coca-Cola recipe, which is available on the internet. But if you're expecting Coke or Pepsi, it doesn't
taste
like
this is so
like
much
it.
Nicer. It's not so as fizzy. Much. It actually feels fruity, but it has got that nod. You know, I would recognise that as a cola or Pepsi, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, cola, I've never been able to drink it even when I was a child.
It's horrible.
Everyone used to go nuts for it, and I'd be like, oh no, just water, please.
You know, it's horrid.
couldn't cope with it. But this is lovely, and it doesn't remind me of that at all.
Yeah.
It's got a nod to it, though.
Yeah.
Mm. But it's really nice and fruity.
Yeah, so we use the lemon and lime juice, which it's kind of for the acid content, and Coca-Cola use phosphoric acid.
Mm.
Which doesn't sound very nice because you wouldn't drink it on its own. Mm.
God, slightly worrying.
It's got brown sugar notes though, hasn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Kind of so we're creating the colour of the drink because the mistake I made when I developed this recipe is for the first, honestly, this is probably recipe number 120. It's the only one that's ever gone into triple digits. I probably did the first 50 thinking I won't bother to work on the colour. I'll just get the flavour right. And I just couldn't do it. I couldn't make it taste of cola. And it wasn't until that we started playing with the sugars and playing with the caramel that we put in to create the colour that I was like, oh no, this is actually not as far away from it as I thought it was.
That's the dimension that I needed, yeah. So to speak.
Yeah.
Excellent. So I'm now going to try lemonade because in my head I have a version of what lemonade should be. This is cloudy.
Mm. It looks like a lovely traditional lemonade, doesn't it?
I think these guys should be going for great taste awards, don't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Have you done that yet?
Yeah, we have.
Oh, need to get them to taste it.
Results are out later on this year.
Oh, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. There we go. Oh, I've just got some of that. Now, already I can smell lemons, and I haven't, it's not anywhere near my nose yet.
Yeah. But it should be cloudy, shouldn't it? How on earth could you have a lemonade that wasn't cloudy?
How do they make lemonade that's not cloudy?
They do a process called clarifying. So they clarify the lemon juice, which strips out all of the
sort of fine
bits. Yeah, exactly.
This is nice. It's not cloudy as in, you know, really cloudy. It's just...
But it's not too sweet either.
No, it's good.
No, that's the secret. If you use actual fruit that is fresh and has been a fruit in the recent past, you don't need to add a lot of sugar to create flavour. The fruit already tastes amazing.
Yeah, it leaves a really clean tongue
really clean.
Afterwards.
I mean, I'd use that to actually clean your palate.
Palate cleansing, yeah. It's lovely. And a really nice long lemon flavour.
Mm. So you've gone out to all these different places. You've tried selling it from kegs and all that sort of stuff. What was the next thing for you? You know, how do you start to embed this brand in, you know, beyond your locality?
Well, so obviously originally we were making it out of our kitchen, which was horrendously sticky and I would not recommend. We did the classic East London business thing of getting a railway arch, and we built a small production facility and started making stuff. We didn't really have a huge amount of money to start up with. We actually borrowed £25,000, and that was basically it. We had completely gotten down to the last £100 when we'd finished installing everything, and we made the first pallet of lemonade. So we didn't really have any other choice. It was it, get back on the bikes and get out to
literally
all
knocking
the different
on
places.
Doors.
Yeah. It's got to work point, hasn't it?
It's got to work, and people have got to pay us so we can make the next batch.
I think you need that moment in business, though, don't you? Where you just think, right, this is us. There is no other alternative. We've got to make this work.
Yeah. I've got to pay the rent on this arch, and I've got to pay the rent on my flat.
Yeah.
And then you've used collaborations, haven't you? How's that worked for you as a sort of marketing tactic?
Yeah, it's a really fun thing to do. I think the most unique thing about Square Root is that we are actually making the product. Mm. And the thing that leaves us open to is we can literally make anything. So someone could come to us with an idea, and if it's an interesting brand and they align with ours, we can make it happen.
So give us an example.
So we, because we come from beer originally, we did lots of different collaborations with breweries. That was just our network. So we've made a lot of shandies. They were really delicious. And because there's so many interesting flavors in beers, you can play so much with that to create an interesting non-alcoholic version of that. But we've done all sorts. In later years, I've always tried to do things that haven't been done before or are like particularly interesting to us. So we did the first collaboration between two soft drinks companies, because there are obviously other companies that have started up now that are also making a product. And that was really exciting because, again, beer is just by nature very collaborative, but the soft drinks industry is tough and mean. and everyone's really competitive. So it was really exciting to collaborate with somebody else in the same category as us, because so often everyone there is just so hostile.
So have you got some examples of some good collaborations that you think people should be considering if they're trying to grow their business, and how it might help their business?
Absolutely. I mean, when we've used collaborations, it's when your business is doing really well in the sphere you're in, you've got a good kind of tribe or collection of people that are following you that are really engaging with your brand. But you know you're missing an area, a target demographic that you really want to click into. Mm. It's finding somebody strategic that's in that place that has a really, really confident set of followers that would, you know, between you, you've got similar values, you've got similar ethics, you've got a similar way of working that you could actually then collaborate and be helpful for both of you. You know, you're then sharing your kind of tribe, you're sharing all this knowledge and practice.
So we had the Snaffling Pig guys on the other week, you know, and they did a collaboration with Coleman's mustard, because that was really helping, you know, pork and whatever.
Nice, yeah.
That makes total sense, isn't it? And trying to sometimes get those sorts of collaborations are really going to help, because they'll already have followers. They'll already have their own, as you said, marketing going on. So they're going to help you, aren't they, promote that?
Absolutely. And there's always something strategic behind the communication of the collaboration. One that I saw in the press a while back was an ice cream company called Granny Gothard's. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly. And they have done a collaboration with, you know, Kraft Heinz and Kellogg's and a number of other really big brands, and created all these absolutely nuts flavors. Yeah, baked bean flavor
ice cream,
soy sauce flavor, salad cream, mayonnaise. I mean, Cocoa Pops. I mean, that kind of makes sense. But I think their message, if I'm right, and it was all presented at Anya Hindmarsh, I think their message was how bespoke they can create all these different flavors, and it just showed how capable they are and how reactive they can be to that kind of thing, which is a really cool message.
I remember once visiting the Wensleydale Creamery up in Yorkshire, I think they are. Obviously, you know, Wensleydale became famous, particularly after the Wallace and Gromit film that was made. This place is in Hawes, I think, in North Yorkshire, in Wensleydale. And of course, they have this cheese, which is quite famous. So then there's the decision. It happened by chance to be mentioned in a Wallace and Gromit film. You know, it's Wensleydale, and it there's a thing about it. Do you then, as a brand, decide, well, we'll hitch a ride with the Wallace and Gromit thing, and maybe we should feature them on our packs, we'll contact them and ask to do a joint branding, you know, or not? Because it does have its risks, doesn't it?
It does have its risks, yeah. And I think you've got to make sure that you are collaborating with somebody that has a really similar kind of ethic and a really similar standing. kind of frequency, if that makes any sense, because it doesn't always go perfectly. Most of the time it does.
Yeah.
You had an example you were saying.
I went to see these guys. It was a very, very long time ago. And I think it's a double-edged sword. So they started putting the Wallace and Gromit thing on some of their packaging because obviously we're working and, you know, got the permission to do so. But then I think some of the sales really helped because children and younger people sort of got the joke and bought it. But actually what it did is it started turning people who were serious cheese lovers off the brand.
Oh, interesting.
Because then they were thinking, well, this isn't a proper, in inverted commas, cheese. It's a cheese that's been made. Wallace said that Wensleydale was his favourite cheese and all that sort of stuff. And actually it hurt their sales in particular areas where they want to be taken seriously.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the message of that, and of course they've come out the other side of that, and they're great cheese producers. But I think the message is you really, really have to think carefully when you do a collaboration, don't you?
You would want to get really, really good TGI data about the brand that you're looking to kind of collaborate with and make sure that it does align, that there is that crossover when it comes to messaging and values and what both of your kind of target demographics care about when you're talking.
I mean, for you, Robin, it would be quite ridiculous to you know, partner with Coca-Cola or Pepsi because they're going against everything that you believe in. So that's not a smart move, is it?
Yeah, exactly. I think it is about finding people who are on your wavelength but outside of your current sphere so that you're reaching those new people.
New market, And what would you do, AJ, in terms of perhaps using a famous person to endorse your brand, you know, in the same sort of way? Can that be helpful? It's expensive, but can that be helpful?
It's really expensive. And interestingly, you know, we were talking about demographics last week. It works better with different demographics. And I think what we've noticed is it all comes down to an authenticity, because if somebody's very famous saying that they like a product, we all know they've been paid to do that. So immediately, certainly for people, you know, maybe the younger generations, they immediately, you know, they can call it. They're thinking, is this really authentic?
Yeah, I mean, if Piers Morgan said he liked your stuff, that would be the end of it. Game over. You'd be...
He's done a lot for vegan products inadvertently, hasn't he?
Just my personal opinion.
Say that he hated it.
Please don't email me about that.
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
Yeah. Again, I'm joking, but it's going to be really important, isn't it, to get the right, if you were going to choose that, to get the right person with the same values. But it is inherently risky, because if that person then does something stupid, so if we take Gary Lineker, for example, very famed for doing Walker's Crisps, Walker's Crisps were invented in Leicester, and he's a Leicestershire chap. But then, I'm not saying he has done this, by the way, completely get that right. But if, for example, he was then caught, I don't know, snorting cocaine or doing something really ridiculous, then that brand, your brand will suffer, won't it? So it's hard to, it can be dangerous to hitch yourself to a particular person.
It can be, and I just wouldn't do it these days.
Really?
I would absolutely.
Not at all.
I wouldn't go for one famous person. I would choose strategic partnerships with people that I think hit different areas of my target demographic in different ways. So, you know, for something like Square Root Soda, you've got a number of different markets of people who are going to enjoy this. And you'll have people that are choosing not to drink alcohol. You'll also have people who just, you know, after the gym or something like that, you'll have parents, you'll have kids. You'll have a lot of different people who would enjoy this. And I would look for different, probably using influencers, different kind of influencers to tap into each of those different markets.
And what's an influencer? So what would you use for Square Root, for example?
You've always given me a hard time about influencers.
I know. Well, it's like,
what is an influencer?
Well, because instinctively it's like no. But they can make a massive impression.
They are.
And that's different from a famous person endorsing your brand. That's completely different, you know, if you're using it in TV or radio advertising or something. This is about somebody who is used to looking at stuff, has got credibility in that area. You send them something to taste and they really like it. And
there's completely different levels. You say it's very different to someone being paid to do it on the TV. Well, not really.
Okay.
Because the really kind of high level influencers are being paid to do this on their kind of YouTube channels and on across all of their different social media. But yes, you do have kind of nano influencers right at the bottom who are just kind of tasting things and just messing around, really. But they have a huge amount of influence, much more than you would believe, really. Something like 84% of product discovery now is via social media. It's the first thing people do when they see a new brand is they go on social media to look at it. They're not going on the website first, which is fascinating.
Do you use influencers?
Oh, we
Robin?
Do. We do.
How do you do that then? And that's working for you?
Yeah, it is. So AJ's completely right. We started with one niche of people who we think would enjoy our drinks, and that's people who don't drink. And then we made relationships with sober influencers on Instagram, on TikTok.
That's why you didn't contact me. I know now. Yeah,
that and the fact you're not on TikTok.
No, no, not any of that stuff. No.
But our focus isn't necessarily people with massive followings. We want to make our marketing budget go as far as possible. Obviously, we're a small company, so we focus on people who make really high quality content, so that. Yes, they're also putting out their followers and we're being discovered by more people, but we can actually use that content again and again and again.
And do you pay that person to do that?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. How much do you have to pay somebody?
It really depends on each individual influencer.
And so do they say, oh, give us 500 quid and I'll do a couple of whatevers, or do you have a sort of long-term contracty thing with them?
It's a bit more collaborative than that, really, isn't it? You kind of sit down with them and you talk about what you're trying to achieve and what they need to continue to do to ensure they don't
so you just
upset
come up with an agreement, basically.
You come up with an agreement, and I think it's pretty much, certainly the way we work, it's unique with every single different influencer we work with. I imagine it's the same for you.
Yeah, which does make it quite time-consuming. Yeah. But it can also be really rewarding. We did a really interesting collaboration with an influencer during the second, third, I don't even remember which lockdown was which anymore. But essentially, we came to the conclusion that, yes, everybody's locked inside, so everybody's really bored. And what can we do on the internet to sort of entertain and get our brand values across? So we decided to partner with a sober influencer to ask people who don't drink, what cocktail do they miss the most that we could make into a product?
Good one.
And then we funneled it down from a huge open question of what the cocktail is to five different cocktails to the one cocktail in three different flavors, and eventually arrived at the mojito, which is now our best-selling alcohol-free cocktail that we make.
Oh, cool.
And it all came out of this campaign
that
ran for 8 weeks.
Would be, because you tested it, so you sort of knew it would. Yeah, you're not guessing. That's great. Well, that's the world of influencers and celebrities and endorsements and all of that. And I think if you are starting a new brand, it is something you do have to think about, don't you? I
agree.
As a food and drink brand, it's going to be very difficult not to survive.
Mm. It takes planning, though, and it takes a little bit of kind of strategic thought.
Yeah, yeah, and presumably searching to see who's writing what and fits in with you before you approach them.
Yeah, often people approach you and just don't be tempted to just go with the people that approach you.
Nobody's ever approached me. What's that then?
Again, you're not on TikTok.
No.
Are you on Instagram?
There is. I don't think so. There is a reason for that, and that I'm on radio. That's a very good reason. It's not visual. We've reached the end of the programme. Robin Sims of Square Root Soda, thank you so much for taking us through that. I think it's really useful for people that are setting up new products, brands, trying to get out there. And I think taking it slowly before you go big, getting it absolutely right, getting all your processes right, and that's the way to go, isn't it? So you've got a solid foundation when the good contracts come in.
Yeah, definitely. My motto is 100% test.
Test. Well, you're a scientist. Mine's throw it to the wind, see what happens. I don't recommend Robin's version if I were you. So thanks, AJ, for joining us. We'll send links
to
Square Root.
I haven't
tasted the raspberry lemonade.
Oh, let's try that one.
Yeah, I'm going to go for that. Have a good week, everybody. Are you going to pour or shall I?